steps led left and right, winding up to the same high point overlooking the room.
"This is the Jordan staircase," Henry said by way of explanation. "Impressive, isn't it?"
"I don't know," Etta said. "I think it could do with a touch more gold."
"More gold?"
He turned toward her, brows furrowed, before his face broke into a wide smile.
"Oh, sarcasm. That's a most unattractive trait in a young lady, you know."
"Yes, sarcasm. One of the many services I have to offer," Etta said, her voice even more dry. "Along with driving Winifred insane." He gave her a knowing look.
"She'll soften, given time."
"The way a fruit softens as it rots away," she guessed. He struggled to summon a stern look.
"That was unkind."
But not untrue. They walked for seemingly forever, until Etta, an experienced city walker, felt like she might want to sit down and take her shoes off, just to spare her toes the agony of being pinched for a few minutes. The rooms blurred together in a rainbow stream, edged, of course, with gold. Blue rooms, green rooms, red rooms. Great halls with chandeliers the size of modern trucks. Ballrooms waiting to be filled with flowers and dancers. Parquet floors whose swirling designs were made up of a dozen types of wood. Marble floors so very glossy Etta could see her reflection as she moved over them. And still, it took another 10 minutes before a crisply dressed servant met them at the base of another grand staircase, and said, in accented English,
"She'll see you in his study before dinner. Shall I show your guests into a drawing room?"
"I think we shall wait," Winifred began.
"I'll be bringing this young lady with me," Henry said. "The rest are to have free range of the rooms to conduct their search."
Etta's gaze slid over to Julian's, just as Winifred drew herself to her full height with a huff, and curled a thin hand over his shoulder.
"Don't leave me," he mouthed as the woman dragged him away, following another servant back down the hall.
Jenkins moved to follow Henry and Etta, but was waved off.
"Sir," he began. "We're safe here," Henry reassured him. "Lock the Ironwood child in a room, and go see to the search. Inform Julian that if he throws a temper tantrum or breaks anything, we'll certainly break something of his."
Jenkins nodded, but didn't look especially pleased as he retreated. The servant opened the door and went inside, but Henry held Etta back a moment.
"This friend of mine is neither a guardian nor a traveler, though he knows of our existence," Henry said,
his voice barely above a whisper.
"I ask that you not share the details of the timeline you grew up with, as it might frighten him into acting rashly."
Etta nodded and reached up again, pushing a rogue strand of hair back out of her face. Sophia had told her in no uncertain terms that to reveal what they could do to any non-traveler brought layers upon layers of consequences. She was surprised Henry was taking the risk at all. Dark wood paneling surrounded them on all sides, making the awkwardly shaped room seem almost coffin-like. It was so aggressively masculine in its bold lines, the air drenched in wood polish and tobacco, that Etta wondered if the room ever received female visitors. Bookcases, most with glass doors, ran along the edge of the room, broken up in places by small oval portraits of men in military uniform. Around a corner, Etta saw a grand piano peeking out. At the center stood an impressive desk, covered with picture frames of all shapes and sizes. She didn't notice the man sitting behind it, a book open under the glow of a brass desk lamp, until he lifted a tumbler of alcohol to his lips.
"Your Imperial Majesty, Mr. Henry Hemlock, and Miss Henrietta Hemlock."
Imperial Majesty. The words dripped through her mind, slow as syrup. As in, the Tsar. All at once she understood the warning that Henry had given her, not to speak of the timeline she'd grown up in. Because this man, who stood only an inch taller than she, with neatly combed brown hair and piercing blue eyes, should have been dead a year ago, along with his whole family.
"Thank you. That will be all,"
Tsar Nicholas II said, dismissing the servant, who gave one last swift bow on his way out.
Mickey,
Henry said simply, and it was Etta's turn to be stunned as he favored the other man with a true, warm smile. His friend. A friend he hadn't saved, or hadn't been able to. One who'd been murdered along with his family, as a new regime had risen to power in his country. Etta's hands felt cold and damp inside of her gloves. This was what it meant to form attachments to people outside of their small, insular world of travelers, Etta realized. They were at the mercy of the timeline. Saving them was no guarantee that events wouldn't change for the worse, but to live with the knowledge of their deaths. Etta glanced at Henry again, took in the way he rubbed a hand over his face, fought to keep his expression from slipping. A sharp jolt of pain went straight through her heart. She knew this feeling. She knew this exact brand of painful elation. Seeing a younger Alice had changed her perception of death entirely, forced her to recognize that time wasn't a straight line. As long as she, as long as any of them, could travel, they wouldn't be constrained by the natural boundaries of life and death. And this was what truly set the Thorns apart from the Ironwoods. The old man only saw humanity as tools to carve and hone his vision of what the world should be. But here, in the way Henry had to press a hand to his face to mask his relief, was a kind of love, a compassion for messy, flawed humanity, a wish to spare this life, just as they had struggled to spare the lives of San Francisco's many fortunate strangers. The thought made Etta eager to leave, to join the other Thorns combing the rooms for the astrolabe. All of this could be over in a night. Less than that.
Oh, dear,
the Tsar said with a faint laugh, extending a hand toward him.
I can't imagine what's about to happen to me to provoke that sort of reaction from you.
His English was better than hers, somehow crisp and smooth all at once, with a refined edge.
No, it's only...
Henry cleared his throat and laughed. He took the Tsar's hand, releasing Etta to clasp it with his other one.
I was only thinking it's been so very long. Will you do me the honor of allowing me to introduce my daughter, Henrietta? Daughter?
The Tsar came around the desk, grinning.
You never said. What a charming beauty she is.
Henry nodded.
And wit to match.
The Tsar smiled.
Of course. Intellect and charm.
It's... Etta realized she should be doing something. Something like curtsying. And did an awkward sort of bob at the knees. It's incredible to meet you. Because honestly, what else could she say? It was incredible, absurd, and more than a little alarming.
The pleasure is, of course, all mine.
The Tsar turned his attention back to Henry, repeating that same stunned exclamation.
Daughter, I wish you had sent word. I would have brought my own with me from Tsarkoyselo. As it was, I hardly had time to travel into the city myself. Please forgive my abhorrent rudeness on the matter. We made an unexpected trip here, as you might have gathered. And regretfully, I only recently became reacquainted with Henrietta, after a number of years apart,
Henry explained.
We've been making up for lost time.
The Tsar's lips twisted into an ironic smile.
It seems odd to me that your kind can lose time, when you stand to gain so much from it. Please, sit, and tell me, how have you been, my old friend? What news from your own war?
Oh my God. The knowledge that he was well aware of their world, and had directly benefited from his association with it, made Etta shift uncomfortably. This was the very first lesson of their world Sophia had given her. How chillingly serious the other girl had been when she'd said, if nothing else, they couldn't reveal themselves or what they could do. They couldn't share news of the future with the past, save the dead from their fates, or even break character. The passivity of it had infuriated her, but to see the effects of breaking those rules now, even in the service of something good, was a little frightening. Etta found herself in a stiff-backed chair, without ever remembering sitting down. Henry settled into the chair beside hers. The Tsar reclaimed his own.
"It continues," Henry said. "I take it you became acquainted with two of my men."
The Tsar sat back in his seat, his hands folded over his chest, his initial pleasure dimmed.
"I think perhaps you already know the answer to that."
Henry tried for a smile.
"Are you furious with me then, Nicky?"
"I was many things," the Tsar said. "Defeated soundly by the once inferior Japan, humiliated in the eyes of my cousins and peers the world over, chastised by the poorest of this country for the conditions they were subjected to, sickened by the Duma taking more and more power, mine by birthright."
Etta tried to fight her cringe as the man's voice grew hoarse.
"Betrayed by former allies, humbled by the notion that I have failed to maintain the power of my father and his father before him. But alive, the Tsar. My country struggles, as all do in the face of great change. But the reforms you encouraged have been a boon, including the cessation of pogroms against the Jews, which I would never have believed."
"The recent disturbances," Henry began, looking troubled.
"Already tidied up," the Tsar finished. "I will find a way to soothe the ruffled feathers."
"I'm certain of it. But what of the treaties?"
"Breaking them came more easily than I might have imagined, with France aiding the revolutionaries, who were misguided in thinking one less monarchy would better the world. It was a simple thing to stand against political assassinations, given the history of my family. Serbia was a sacrifice, but one that kept us from war."
The First World War, Etta thought, straightening. Russia had lost millions of soldiers, the badly managed effort, the poor conditions at home, and the machinations of other governments had all led to the ousting of the Tsar, and his own eventual assassination.
"I hated you. Bitterly. I'm afraid. For countless years," the Tsar said. "I cursed you with every breath. But I trusted you, and preyed on each decision. Your family has been the steward of mine for many generations, the caretaker of this land for longer than even the Romanovs."
"As in, guiding their choices?" Etta wondered. "Advising them on the right ones to make? How was that any different than what the Ironwoods were doing?" "I thought you were against interfering in the timeline," Etta asked Henry, however rude they might think her for interrupting.
"Oh, no, Etta. It's not quite like that," he said quickly. "We worked very diligently to protect the timeline from the changes other families were making, especially as they pertained to ruining the fortunes of this part of the world."
"That is true," the Tsar said. "They have never bowed to the demands of my family for more information, for ways to overcome our enemies. They have been protectors, not puppeteers."
Settled somewhat, Etta nodded. Henry turned back to the Tsar.
"The Germans no longer had quite as much interest in your rule, did they?" Henry said knowingly. "Once they considered you humiliated after the war with Japan, did they even bother with Lenin?"
The Tsar shook his head.
"And now they are quite busy, as is the rest of the world, with pulling themselves back together after their own humiliation. Your traveler war seems to be the only one which cannot find its end."
Henry smiled.
"We might surprise you yet. Did one of my men indicate they would be hiding something in the palace during their visit in 1905? Do you recall?"
The Tsar stroked his mustache.
"I'm afraid not. They were harried and bloodied, in no state to do anything but hand off your letter. The guards were reluctant to let them in to see me. They were given food and rooms to rest, but by dinner they had fled again.
I'll have one of the maids show you to their rooms after dinner. You'll stay and dine with me, won't you? Your men will be busy searching. There are 1,500 rooms here, you'll recall.
And how many hundreds of hiding places in each? Impatience stirred in her. We'll be searching for days.
Where is your foe now? I'm not sure I've ever seen you look quite so relaxed.
My spies have Ironwood safely ensconced in an earlier century, in Manhattan. His men are far too distracted by the changes in America to focus on you and your country.
I'm glad to hear it, the Tsar said,
showing what Etta thought was admirable restraint in not pushing for more details. The man took only what was offered, though he probably had ways and means of demanding more. He reached back for his glass and held it up in Henry's direction.
Yes, thank you,
Henry said as the Tsar crossed the room to a small cabinet, where a crystal decanter was stored.
I'll take one too, Etta said before she could stop herself.
The Tsar laughed as he poured out the liquor into the two glasses, but Etta wasn't joking. She could have used the liquid courage to prop her nerves up. Her back only straightened as the Tsar passed the glass to Henry and resumed his former position.
"Tell me about yourself, my dear," he said. "I'm afraid you've got me at a disadvantage, as you'll likely know more about me than even I do."
Etta swallowed again, feeling Henry's gaze bore into the side of her head. "Well," she began, "I grew up with my mother in New York City, sometime past, now." The Tsar raised his glass to Henry.
"For your own protection, I'm sure. A wise choice, my friend. There are times I wish I had done it myself. But continue, child."
"I'm not sure there's anything else all that interesting," Etta said. Then added, "Beyond the obvious, I mean. I've recently begun to travel. I do play the violin, too."
"A fine pursuit." "The Tsar is a great lover of music," Henry explained, visibly relaxing. "You should know, Your Imperial Majesty, that Henrietta has quite undersold herself. She's exceedingly talented, and has won numerous international competitions for her skill."
Etta turned toward him, her heart in an absolute riot, because for a minute he'd sounded like he was bragging about her. To the last Tsar of Russia.
"Brilliant," the Tsar said. "You'll play for me, won't you?"
Yes. What? Etta blinked.
"She's got Tchaikovsky in her repertoire," Henry continued.
"I do, but..."
"The violin concerto, no doubt,"
the Tsar said, crossing the room in quick several strides. He retrieved a small case from where it was tucked beneath the piano. That looks like... a violin case. "Oh," Etta said, feeling rather stupid. "You mean right now?" The Tsar's smile fell somewhat as he set the case down on his desk.
"I shouldn't have presumed you'd feel comfortable."
"No, I'm happy to," she said. The usual tingle of stage fright was gone, swept off by an overpowering sense of longing for the instrument, for the music. Weeks had passed since the concert at the Met, and Etta hadn't gone longer than 2 days without playing since she was 5 years old. The anticipation hit her like a drug, and she was shaking with it.
"Wonderful. It will send us to dinner on a pleasing note. Henry, you'll accompany her, won't you?"
Henry stood too, ignoring Etta's look of surprise. "Accompany her." The violin concerto was generally played with a full orchestra, but there was, of course, a reduction for a simple violin and piano duet. Sure enough, Henry was moving toward the piano, trailed by the Tsar. He took a seat at its bench.
"Perhaps just the first movement," he suggested. "Unless you'd prefer the second."
"Yes. I mean, of course, the first movement is fine." Etta realized that she was still standing by the Tsar's desk, stunned and trembling with nerves, and quickly moved to join them. She accepted the violin, taking a moment to simply feel the slight weight of it in her hands.
to let her palm run down the graceful neck, along the striped grain of the wood. There was a single moment when she debated the propriety of taking off her gloves, but went for it regardless, needing to feel the instrument against her fingertips. She tossed the long lengths of silk over the back of the nearest chair. If the Tsar was scandalized, he didn't show it, merely wetting his mustache as he took another deep sip of his drink. Henry pushed back his sleeves, giving himself more freedom of movement. Etta wondered if he was truly planning to play without any sheet music, and felt a swell of admiration despite herself.
"When you're ready," he said.
She drew the instrument up, tucking it beneath her chin. She'd played this piece any number of times, the last of which being the competition in Moscow. Alice had never favored it all that much, despite its dominance in their world, and loved to repeat an early review of the concerto that claimed to play it was to beat the violin black and blue. She only hoped she remembered it well enough to do it justice, and not humiliate herself in front of her, in front of her father again, like she had at the Met concert. Her left shoulder stung with the effort of keeping the instrument up, but Etta pushed past the strain, forcing her hands to stop shaking, and drew the bow against the strings. She nodded to Henry, who made his gentle entrance into the piece on the piano, launching them into the music. And that was how Etta found herself playing Tchaikovsky's violin concerto in the early 20th century for Tsar Nicholas II. The piece wasn't just hard, it was devilishly difficult, to the point where Etta wondered if Henry hadn't suggested it because of Tchaikovsky's obvious ties to Russia, but because he wanted to showcase her skills in the flashiest way possible. But from the first note it was like learning to breathe again, the simple relief of hearing the music, using that part of her mind and heart. The tactile presence of the violin swept her away as she began, gliding into the gorgeous framework Henry established, announcing the piece's main theme. The first movement of the concerto built and built, adding a theme, repeating the main theme, creating variations that grew more athletic. The runs became faster, reaching an amazing cadenza that made Etta's heart feel like it would burst from the joy of it. Her eyes flicked over to Henry, watching his own eyes slide shut, as if imagining each phrase as he carved it out on the keys, an expression of pure, unselfconscious joy. "This is where it came from," she thought in wonder. "I inherited it." And that was what she would still have, now that she had altered the course of her life. No concerts, no competitions or debuts. Simple joy. And much like seeing how Henry had nudged the timeline to reveal its secrets, it wasn't bad. It was different. It was a new, sweeter future to match the world's. When it was over, Etta reluctantly lowered the violin and let the world back in. The Tsar clapped, rising to his feet.
"Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful, the two of you. Perhaps we won't discuss business after, but we'll simply play."
There was a faint knock at the door, and the same servant that had escorted them in stepped back inside at the Tsar's command to enter.
Of course. Every dream ends. That will be dinner, then," he said, retrieving the violin from Etta.
As they walked to dinner, trailing the Tsar, Henry whispered,
"You've got an odd look on your face. Is something the matter?"
"No, I just..." Etta lifted her gaze off the plush carpet and looked at the man ahead of them. "It surprised me that he's just a normal person. That he's a real person. I mean, not just words on paper or a photograph. And nice." Even with the infinite possibilities of time travel, Etta hadn't truly considered that she might meet someone famous or noteworthy. She and Nicholas had kept themselves, avoiding the people around them as much as possible, and she'd assumed it was the same with other travelers, too. All her life she'd thought of these historical figures as still lifes, to be studied through a layer of distance and glass, like precious objects in a museum. Henry snorted.
"He's real, all right, and as fallible as any of us uncrowned mortals. He is rather nice to his friends, But of course, there have been many versions of his life that have seen him oppressive, cruel to those of other beliefs, foolish, and even blind to the needs of his most vulnerable subjects. You could say it was because he came to power too soon, before he was ready. Because he picked poor advisers, or that it was a collision of unfortunate events. But I've seen it time and time again. He cannot stop the march of a future that no longer has a place for him and his family.
He's killed in this original timeline, too, Etta whispered. Henry rubbed a gloved hand over his forehead, considering his answer.
His death. It's inevitable. The events leading up to it grew worse and worse with Ironwood's interferences and alterations. But it has happened, and it will happen. Only this time, it must play out the way it was intended a year from now.
He took a deep breath.
You remember what I told you before, that we must accept it. We must be ready to sacrifice what we have in order to see the well-being of the whole. When I was younger, I came up with so many scenarios, so many different plans of how to save him, this one life, and still keep the timeline intact. But the pattern is undeniable. He is taken again and again. We are separated again and again. That is why I believe that certain things are destined. I can see the patterns. I cannot deny the repetition and the greater purpose they are trying to serve. At least in this timeline, I can be content in knowing the rest of his family will only go into exile.
A tremor of sadness in the words, but also resignation.
Etta, I wish I could spare you this, but it is inevitable that you too will be asked to relinquish something. You will see the pattern too.
Etta tightened her grip on his arm, giving him a reassuring squeeze. In truth, she didn't know how to comfort him, or what to say. But she was grateful beyond words that he could see his friend again, even if it was for the last time. She would have shattered every rule the travelers had ever imposed if it meant being able to throw herself into Nicholas's arms and feel his steady heartbeat murmuring beneath her cheek. As much as he presented himself to the world with a grin and an infectious laugh, every now and then Etta caught a glimpse of the part of himself that Henry tried to hide. It complicated her perception of him, made her want to study him that much more closely. She'd had a hard time seeing how her mother, who was so cold and sharp at times that she could cut without a single word, had ever found herself entangled with someone who acted as though laughing and smiling were as necessary to him as oxygen. But now Etta had seen the embattled parts of him. She'd witnessed that irresistible quality he had that made him a friend of Czars and Thorns alike.
"Henrietta. Etta," he corrected himself.
Her heart gave a twist at his gentle tone.
"You play exceptionally well. My compliments to Alice. I don't think she'd mind my saying that you surpass even her skill."
He'd heard Alice play at some point. She smiled sadly. It helped, somehow, to know that someone else remembered the way Alice had made her violin sing.
"Thank you," Etta said.
"How long have you played the piano?"
"Nearly my whole life," Henry said. "From before I was tall enough to reach the pedals."
Etta nodded, her fingers pressing against his sleeve. It must be hard to find time to play, what with all the traveling, hiding, scheming.
"Not as hard as you might think," he said. "I make time. It's true that altering timelines or events is a kind of creation, but there are always consequences, good or bad. Music is something I can create that is neither. It simply is the meeting of the composer's mind with my heart."
"Oh, dear," he laughed.
"Don't tell anyone I said that. It's rather maudlin, even for me."
Etta smiled. It had made perfect sense to her.
"Why do you play?" he asked her. "Not just play. Why would you want to make it your life?"
Etta had been asked this question so many times over the years, by Alice, by reporters, by other performers, and had asked it of herself even more often. Every answer had been a reprise of the same practiced refrain. And yet here, with Henry, she felt safe enough to admit the other truths. The ones she had pushed so far back in her heart they'd begun to rust. The ones she hadn't even shared with Nicholas. I wanted to find something that would make Mom proud of me. Something I could excel at, she told him. But some part of me thought that if I was out there performing, if everyone knew my name, I might reach my father or his family. They might recognize me. They'd hear my music and want to come find me. Know me. She let out a deep breath. It's stupid, I know. Up ahead, the Tsar had slowed to greet Winifred and Jenkins near yet another of the palace's elaborate doors. Their voices carried down the hall, punctuated by polite laughter. Just as Winifred turned to make her way over to them, Henry looked away, thumbing at his eye. When he looked back at her, nearly stricken, she wasn't sure what to do, other than tighten her hold on his arm. They were still feeling around each other's edges, trying to learn the same etude, each trial bringing them closer and closer to learning the skills of caring for the other.
I heard you, Essa, he said softly. I heard you.
Carthage, 148 BC. 15. The man in the darkness stepped closer, his footsteps muffled by nearby insects and a cloud of disturbed birds launching into the night sky.
That's quite far enough, Nicholas said, raising the sword so that its tip rested at the man's throat.
His eyes bulged at the implicit threat, but he did as he was told. Nicholas took careful stock of him. He was stooped at the shoulders, like a man who'd spent his life out in the fields, toiling over a plow. His red tunic was threadbare, nearly as weathered as the deep-set wrinkles in his ragged, dark skin. All of this was offset by a shock of white hair. His thick beard and brows looked as though they'd been left out to gather frost.
"What business do you have here, travelers?"
the man demanded.
"How did you find us?"
What Nicholas could see of the man's legs looked thin, almost knobby-kneed, and that general unsteadiness likely accounted for his slight limp and his reliance on a tall walking stick.
"My name is Nicholas Carter," he said. "We've come to trade information. Nothing more."
"No, child. All you've done is bring the shadows, disturb our peace," he said hoarsely,
his gaze darting around the courtyard, as if expecting to find someone else there. There was that word again, shadows, and always whispered as if to avoid summoning them. Sophia snorted at the word peace.
"It's not about Ironwood. We want a true trade. We have information we could share, but we've also got food."
She held up her sack of elephant feed.
"Food we'd be willing to part with for answers to a few questions that would stay between us. Which one are you? Remus or Fitzhugh?"
"Remus."
The old man muttered something else to himself, one hand rubbing the other as he looped the bow over his shoulder. His gaze drifted away, his breath coming in quick, urgent bursts.
"Sir, time is of the essence in this matter," Nicholas tried.
The man leaped back as if struck.
"All right, yes. Come with me," he said,
voice strained.
"Yes, follow me. Quickly now. It will be all right."
"We'll see about that," Sophia said,
and her words leached the rest of the color from the man's face. His senses were piqued, his attention snared and drawn back toward the stables. Voices were rising, and the sound of the elephant's cries had ceased altogether. It seemed their diversion had run its course.
"It is lucky you survived,"
the man told them as they moved through the night.
"But far luckier indeed that you did not cause a change to the timeline with that elephant stunt."
Fair point. Nicholas knew that his luck was bound to run out, but having received so little of it in his life, he was willing to push on to find its limits. Still, he couldn't release the last few tremors of doubt as he followed the man's unsteady steps, any more than he could take his eyes from him. It was unfair, perhaps, given that the man had saved them when he could just as easily have left them to die on the attacker's blade.
but he couldn't change his nature in a night.
"Ease up and unclench, will you?" Sophia muttered, taking notice. "He's ancient, and he'll have a pot to boil whatever it is we just stole from the elephants."
"You're thinking with your stomach, not with your head,"
he sniped back quietly.
"Didn't you catch what he said about the shadows?" she whispered. "He knows who they are."
Remus spun around, his voice low. "For the love of Christ, do you want someone to hear you speaking another language and assume you've snuck in? I won't be saving you then, believe me."
Nicholas and Sophia kept their mouths shut. A good thing, because as they rounded onto the next street, Nicholas had to take a generous step back to avoid crossing into the path of several women, heading the opposite way, toward the homes they had passed, where candles were lit and waiting for them. The ladies' dresses were longer and somehow more elegantly draped than the simple tunics of the men, their gauzy hems swirling around their sandaled feet. One nodded as Nicholas passed her, with dark hair shorn shorter than even Sophia's.
"Lice?"
Sophia asked Remus cautiously, once they were clear of the street and onto a far smaller and quieter one. He shook his head.
"They cut their hair to give to the soldiers for their bows. Do you know nothing, child?"
Sophia made an insolent face behind his back.
"Why would they need to?" Nicholas asked. "I thought they were renowned for their military."
"They are a fierce people," Remus said,
his voice sounding steadier the farther they walked from the city center, away from anyone who might overhear them.
"Every man, woman, and child is or will be armed and expected to fight. Each home is a fortress in and of itself. They are rebuilding their arsenal."
"What happened to their original weapons?" Nicholas asked.
"When the Romans landed on these shores, they demanded hostages and the whole of the city's arms, which they were given. But that was not enough. The Carthaginians defied them, taunted them, even tortured Roman prisoners in full sight of the Roman army. And so it goes."
"The Romans are building something out in the harbor, aren't they?"
Remus gave him an exasperated look.
"A mole, yes."
As he'd suspected, moles were massive structures, built from rock, stone, or wood, to be used as a kind of pier or breakwater. In this instance, it would seal up all of the warships he'd seen in the military harbor. As the sun started to climb, they began their ascent up the hill toward the citadel that overlooked the harbor. Birsa, the old man called it. Nicholas kept his head down as they moved. The men and women here wouldn't be alarmed or find his dark skin particularly noteworthy. But he knew from long experience that men were unlikely to remember someone who didn't meet their gaze. His sandals shuffled along the worn stone, his thoughts dwindling to merely left, right, left, right, to order himself to keep going. He didn't look up until he was met with the sight of feet less than half the size of his own, bare and covered in cuts and sores. The dark-skinned boy stepped aside quickly, allowing Remus, who was building speed like a churning storm, to hobble past. Sophia slid around Nicholas, shooting him an irritated look as she continued on ahead. The boy couldn't have been more than 8 or 9, Nicholas decided. Too small and wasted to the very bone. His tunic hung off his shoulders in tatters, knotted here and there in awkward lumps to keep it on him. The boy met his gaze from beneath his mass of matted hair. His dark eyes were bold with pride, in absolute defiance of his dismal state. Nicholas knew that look well. The pride meant going hungry in silence, rather than lowering oneself to ask for charity, or begging. He'd been the same way, even as a slave, even once he was freed by the kindness of the halls. If the captain hadn't force-fed him the first few nights, Nicholas wouldn't have eaten at all. "You've the pride of Lucifer," Hall had informed him. "It's the only thing that family gave you, and believe me, you don't need that inheritance." Unbidden, his mind drew up the image of the child he and Sophia had seen earlier in the night, dead and wasted away from disease and hunger, left in the street like a common animal. Nicholas gave the boy a tentative smile and lifted his bag from his shoulder, carefully removing the few things he might need from it, leaving only the food.
The leather bag's design was simple enough to pass for something created in this time, and he doubted the boy would take care to notice it all that much. Careful not to say anything, he held it out toward him. The boy stared at him, and Nicholas knew the moment he'd understood the gift. He snatched the strap of the bag from Nicholas's hands. Nicholas let out a faint laugh, but as he turned away, a small hand caught his wrist, forcing him to turn back around. The boy's fingers disappeared inside of his shirt, and he tugged off a thin strand of leather Nicholas hadn't noticed before. Dangling from it was a small pendant, just smaller than Nicholas's little finger. The boy held it up, gazing at him with fierce, dark eyes, until Nicholas took it. "A trade, then." Nicholas nodded in thanks, and the boy turned and ran, never once looking back. He studied the unexpected gift, holding it up to the light. It was a face, glass that had been painted or colored somehow, and shaped to resemble a man with a curling row of hair, dark brows, large eyes, and a rather magnificent beard that extended from his chin and ringlets. An amulet, perhaps. He shifted the objects he'd retrieved from his bag in his arms, and with enough care that his hands shook from it, slid the glass bead onto the leather cord around his neck, next to Etta's earring.
"Carter!"
Sophia barked. Nicholas's long legs devoured the distance between him and Sophia and Remus, who had watched the exchange with suspicious eyes. He didn't look back, didn't want to give the boy the opportunity to refuse his gift. "Stay alive," he thought. "Stay alive. Escape."
"You are ridiculous," Sophia said in a low voice. "How will you continue to play the hero if you don't eat?"
"I'll find something else," he said.
"I've gone longer without." Hunger was tolerable. The alternative was to be haunted by those eyes, by the bitter sort of regret that wouldn't ever dissolve, no matter how much sweetness the years brought. It wasn't a weakness to have those thoughts, to feel that need to help another, to save lives. It made one human. He couldn't help but think that the travelers had fallen too deep into the practice of being silent witnesses. It drained the empathy from them, allowed them to build a wall of glass between themselves and suffering. Sophia looked at him, making a strained sound.
"All you're doing is prolonging the inevitable. Isn't it better to go this way than suffer what the Romans have in store for him?"
"I'm not heartless," she'd said. And so she wasn't. Their hearts were made of different fibers, and perhaps her heart was more durable for that sort of decision than his own. He was too exhausted to argue with her. Sophia's feet, much like his own, were dragging across the stones. Even her words lacked their usual venom and conviction.
"Is Fitzhugh at home now?"
Nicholas asked the old man instead. Remus shook his head.
"No. My husband's a physician, you see. He is out making his rounds to visit the ill. It was left to me to investigate who came through the passage."
"You heard it from all the way up here?"
Nicholas asked, glancing back over his shoulder at the city spread out below. The pale hue of the limestone was all the more breathtaking in the early morning, with the tint of violet spread over it. He'd lost the sound of the passage as they'd slipped further into the city. All he could hear now was the distant banging of the blacksmiths who had woken with the dawn.
"We are near the other passage," Remus said. "It resonates with its brother in the water. Dreadful noise, but useful in knowing when to expect company."
Nicholas nodded. "Satisfied, detective," Sophia said. "Might we try for a bit of shutting up now? Tonight's given me a crashing headache."
Remus's pace slowed as they reached the next door. He turned one last time to press his fingers against his lips before pushing it open. It creaked painfully, scraping the uneven stone. Nicholas ducked beneath the low arch and stepped into a small, shady courtyard, one hand on the hilt of his sword.
"This way,"
Remus whispered. Nicholas cast one last look around, searching for any potential entrances. Piles of bows, swords, shields, and spears rested beside brooms and other simple household tools. waiting. The prickle anxiety fizzed in his blood. There was one way in, yes, which meant it would be easier to keep watch for trouble. But it also meant there was only one way out if trouble did actually arrive. The three of them went up a steep stack of steps to the second level, where a second door waited. Remus cast one last nervous glance around before opening it and ushering them inside. The smell of earth and greens had bled into the dry air, giving the room a musty, medicinal smell that instantly put Nicholas back in a place of unease. Physicians in his time were often no better than butchers, their tools as dull as their skills. On the left side of the room was a bed pressed against the wall, with strands of greens left to dry over it. The opposite wall was dedicated to Fitzhugh's work, more drying herbs and plants, along with small vials and ceramic pots, a grinding stone, and a rudimentary scale. Across the room, below the windows, was a carefully arranged living area. There was a low table, a rug to cover the polished stone floor, a chair and pillows on which to sit. At the center of it all was a hearth, with a pot boiling over, spitting bubbling water into the hissing fire below. It was a comfortable home, but nothing like he would have expected for two travelers. To their credit, at least there were no outward hints that they weren't native to this era. Most travelers, as he'd seen even with Etta's great-grandfather, couldn't resist the temptation to cobble together small stashes of trinkets and souvenirs. Instead, there were just a few small statues and stone figurines of foreign ancient gods.
"We can eat and discuss whatever it is you're here for after I finish my rest, and you've had some yourself," Remus said, sitting on the bed and removing his battered shoes. "At a decent hour."
"Time is not on our side," Nicholas began,
even as Sophia made herself a small bed from the pillows near the hearth and table.
"When is it ever, my lad?"
the man said, as the feather mattress and rope frame settled beneath him.
"When is it ever?"
"How can you be sure the attackers will not bother us?" Nicholas asked. "That they haven't tracked us here?"
"They move in darkness," the man said,
blowing out the candle on the table beside the bed.
"We are safe, for now."
Nicholas released his frustration in a harsh breath, but found a place to stretch out on the rug. The uneven ground beneath him was as unforgiving as it was in every other century he'd recently visited. He took the opportunity to assess his aches and cuts, as well as the new hot spikes of pain in his right hand. Holding it up, he examined the pattern etched into the ring in the soft morning light. He tried tugging it off again. Failed. With another snort, he crossed his arms and turned his back to the wall, closing his dry eyes. But he did not sleep. His mind did not relent in trying to chase the ghost of Etta's face, remembering how sweetly her body had curved against his own. Nor did it allow him to ignore the familiar pressure of someone's gaze taking the measure of him. But hours later, when Nicholas finally turned over to confirm his suspicions of being observed, Remus had dipped deeply into his dreams, and the only thing that moved beyond the door was the lonely wind. Hours later, as the sun swept into the room and the fire warmed its confines, Nicholas propped himself up against the table on the floor and attempted to stay awake, or at least alert. Sophia, who had slept without a second thought, drummed her fingers on the low table, impatient for the man to finish brewing his tea and cooking the oats.
"There you are," Remus said,
offering a cup of the former to Sophia, wincing as the hot tea splashed out of the small wooden cup and onto his trembling hands. Without any sort of prompting, he pressed another cup into Nicholas's hands, turned back to fill one of his own.
"We need to agree to secrecy before we begin," Nicholas said. "What we discuss here cannot leave this room."
Remus's brows rose.
"Who do you think I would tell beyond Fitzhugh? We don't exactly receive guests, and even if we wanted to, Cyrus has forbidden contact.
I cannot contact my Jacaranda family any more than Fitz could his immediate Ironwood family. He would have us killed for disobeying his explicit orders.
Nicholas should have known that. He himself had been exiled, confined to his natural time. But the man's words did not sound promising for the information they needed.
"Let's get on with this business, then, my new friends," Remus said. "Ask me your questions. I have a few of my own."
Sophia blew on her cup of tea, then took a deep gulp. Her face screwed up, lips puckering.
"Why does it taste like I'm drinking dirt?"
"It's green tea," Remus said indignantly. "It tastes of the pure earth. It's not readily available in this era and continent, so have some respect for my hospitality."
"Whatever you say."
Nicholas had always been one for coffee over tea, the bitterest, darkest coffee available, but he was willing to try any sort of stimulant to keep his thoughts sharp. He raised his own cup to his mouth, letting it wet his lips. It smelled of wet grass, and what taste he got was sour, not at all fortifying or refreshing. Setting it on the ground beside him, he leaned forward against the table.
"We're hoping to discover the last common years of the two most recent timeline shifts. Have you received any notices about them?"
The man looked stunned.
"Oh, I'm afraid you've gravely overestimated how much contact we have with the outside world. In case it wasn't clear, none. We don't receive notices from the messengers anymore because we're not allowed to travel, and therefore any dangers the shifts present don't affect us. We've been trapped in this era for years, with no communication, no food, no assurances we'll ever be allowed to leave."
Damn it all, Nicholas thought, weary and frustrated down to his soul. But of course.
"You were stupid enough to think he'd forgive you if you came back groveling," Sophia said, one brow arched.
"I wished he'd just gone and executed us then, with all the others. The bastard put us here because he knew it would be our tomb, and that we'd think every day of what we did to spite him, and regret it," Remus said. "Now Fitz and I only regret the cowardice of leaving the Thorns. It was rough living, especially when it seemed as if Ironwood had massacred half their ranks. But tell me, with everything going on, is he sufficiently distracted now for Fitz and I to make our leave to another era undetected? He told us there were men posted at the entrances to both passages to ensure we could not leave."
"There was no one at the one we came through," Sophia admitted. "Did you really not even check? Ever?"
"No. His rage is absolute, and we were foolish enough to think we might earn our forgiveness eventually, with good service to him."
Remus laughed darkly.
"What a fool I've been. Well, no more. Fitz and I will accompany you to the other passage out of the city when he returns. We'll disappear this time."
Nicholas approved of the manner in which the old man's words vibrated with fuming resentment. Rubbing his tingling hand, he watched Remus for any signs of deceit, and found only the portrait of a man hardened by the bitter taste of disappointment.
"I thought for sure you came because of the work I'd done on the shadows, the research Cyrus had me conduct," Remus said, rising to stir the oats.
Testing their consistency, he scooped out two steaming bowls to serve to his guests.
"Ancient traveler lore, yes. I can assist you with... It's very likely the only thing I'm good for these days. The rest is beyond my sight and knowledge."
Nicholas was momentarily distracted by how hard he had to grip the wooden spoon in his hand to feel it. Batting down the fear pawing at his heart, he turned the whole of his attention to the food. The oats were plain and burned his tongue, but Nicholas was sure neither he nor Sophia had ever consumed a meal with more speed.
"Is there anyone who might be willing to help us discover the last common year, without it getting back to Ironwood?"
Nicholas asked, setting his empty bowl aside. Remus considered this.
"Most of his large alterations were made in the 19th and 20th centuries. You might try asking a guardian named Isabella Moore, in Boston. Ironwood had her son killed around the same time Fitzhugh and I left to join the Thorns, and I know her to be well-connected, but with no love of the man. Try her any time after 1916, and before 1940.
Another lead, which might go just as far as this one did in answering the question. Nowhere. He forced his good hand to release the edge of the table he'd been gripping.
What did you mean when you said you thought we were coming because of the shadows?
Sophia asked, blowing on the surface of her tea before taking a deep gulp of it.
What do you know of them?
Remus looked offended when she let out what was either a small hiccup, belch, or some charming combination of the two.
First, I think you ought to be honest about what you're truly searching for, he said. For I've only ever known them to hunt one thing, the astrolabe.
Nicholas felt the skin on the back of his neck start to crawl. Even Sophia choked on the last sip of her tea.
Surprised, Remus said. Cyrus never changes, not even in the most dangerous of times. But then, of course, knowledge is power. All the more reason for him to hoard the truth about its history and nature.
That Nicholas could not dispute.
And you know of it how? Before Ironwood did away with the position, I was a record keeper for the families for longer than you've been alive, Remus explained. I know things that would slow the blood in your veins. It's one of the reasons he was so irate when we left, you see. He did not want anyone else to have that knowledge, least of all Henry Hemlock. But he cannot execute me either, for the old records were burned, and I might have one last detail or piece of knowledge he needs. I know that, to create a passage, legend holds that you must have the astrolabe, but you must also have something from the time and year you wish to go. I know the songs all others have forgotten.
Sophia gave Nicholas a nod, confirming all of these things.
What do you know of alchemy? Remus began. Of its principles.
I know it's a load of garbage, Sophia said. Outdated hogwash that has spurred on countless pitiful idiots to waste their time trying to turn lead to gold, look for a cure for all ailments, and find a way toward immortality.
Sophia,
Nicholas said, his tone warning. He didn't want to scold her, but he wanted to get what information they could and leave this place as quickly as possible.
You've covered some of it, yes, but the principles of alchemy extend far beyond the tangible. You might say that it is the search for understanding about the true nature of life, and how energy can be manipulated. A careful study of the beautiful mysteries of life, death, and perhaps resurrection. As above, so below. As within, so without. As the universe, so the soul.
That might explain some of the old symbols he had seen in the Belladonna's store and workshop then. It was as much a belief system as a craft or profession.
There once lived a man who achieved this perfect knowledge by broadening his understanding of how immortality might be accomplished. What better way to conquer life than to destroy that which limits it?
Time, Nicholas finished.
You mean to say, this man, the originator of our line,
Remus continued,
harnessed these energies, transmuted them into something new, something tied to the earthly influence of his own blood. It was contained within a device, a key that allowed him to control it. Three copies of this master key were made for his three children, but each copy was weaker than the next. His children fought viciously for control of the original version, each with what they thought was the true path for it, until one day two of the children turned on the youngest, who they felt was the alchemist's favorite. When the alchemist attempted to intervene, both he and the youngest child were killed in the fray.
There's the ironwood in them, Sophia muttered.
In the chaos, the master key was stolen by a fourth child, an illegitimate bastard, a byblow of some poor wench.